This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Even as the coronavirus continues to rip across the globe, scientists are optimistic.
I've never seen vaccine development move quicker.
The Trump administration reversed course this week. International students are again welcome to study in the U.S. this fall. But will they come?
Visas aren't as easy to process as before. So they're wondering whether they should switch to the U.K. or Australia.
And the Queen of the Skies is being grounded in the U.K.
It was the jumbo jet, wasn't it? It was clearly visible as being distinguished from any other aircraft that had ever flown before.
British Airways says goodbye to the 747. Also ahead, an oil tanker off the coast of Yemen is a ticking environmental time bomb. All that's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. What should a country do when a citizen leaves and joins a terrorist group overseas, then wants to return home? That debate has taken a twist in the UK. Shamima Begum left Britain at age 15 and joined the Islamic State in Syria. Last year, she was discovered in a refugee camp there and appealed to come home. But the British government revoked her citizenship. This week, a British court ruled that Shamima Begum can return home to challenge the government's decision. Joining me now is Azadeh Movani, an American-Iranian journalist and author who has written about women who have left their home countries to join ISIS. Her book is called Guesthouse for Young Widows. Azadeh Movani, is this week's news unexpected?
It's extraordinary, actually, because the British government has taken a very hard line around the repatriation of its citizens who affiliated or joined ISIS in Syria. They've probably taken the most dramatically hard line of any country in the world of these 60 countries that have citizens in this situation. It stripped the citizenship of most of its nationals and essentially left them in a sort of legal black hole in an area of Syria where there is no state, there is no justice system. Yeah, so I don't think anyone was really expecting it, even though there was kind of long-standing belief that the government's position was unlawful, but it was popular. These young women are quite reviled in the UK and in much of Europe, so it's a dramatic turnaround.
At this point, Shamima Begum is 20 years old. She's given birth to 3 children in Syria, but all have died. What do we know, if anything, about the circumstances she's living in now?
Well, I've been to the camp where she's being held now. It is, you know, it is a desolate place. I mean, these detention camps in Syria are rife with disease. There's not adequate water. There's not adequate sanitation. She's not being given access and has not been given access to legal counsel. Her lawyers have gone there to try it and meet with her, and she hasn't been allowed to meet with them. So she's not really been given, you know, the things that under the Geneva Convention, even a prisoner would be entitled to, medical care and counsel. So, you know, these are camps where, you know, dozens of people die, you know, each month because of the conditions. So, you know, you can sort of see why the court has concluded that this is not a feasible place for her to launch an appeal from.
Have you spoken to Shamima Begum?
I have not spoken to her. You know, I'm one of the people who went to that camp and tried to speak with her. British reporters, tabloid reporters who found her, did a spate of early interviews with her that were very damning, that I think allowed her to be sort of trial by media. She was very traumatized. She had just given birth. Her baby had just died. And, you know, she said some things that made her look unrepentant. And I think it didn't really enter much of the reporting about her that she had been groomed as a 15-year-old to be recruited into this armed group. She was a child bride. You know, ISIS was recruiting young girls for essentially sexual exploitation.
If Shamima Begum is able to get back to the UK to challenge the British government's decision, is there a chance that she could be arrested upon arrival?
I think it's very possible. I mean, I think she could be in some sort of custodial detention and might well be for her own safety. I've been reporting her story for years now, and the dark web around Shamima Begum is very dark indeed. You know, much of it is deeply racialized. It's kind of hateful towards her for being a woman and for being a brown woman. And of course, you know, the sort of the associations with ISIS. It sort of brings together a real dark vortex of racism and understandable abhorrence of terrorism at the same time. I would imagine that there would be something like that. She's such a high-profile case, I think it might be even unsafe for her to be able to go home. Yeah, but one thing I think is this is going to have real implications for is the rest of the Brits that are being held in northeast Syria. There are 15 to 20 families, women and children who are in similar situations to Shamima have had their citizenship stripped. And will this then kind of have implications for them? And I think it will.
It's interesting to me that you seem to have a lot of sympathy for her. And I guess I'm wondering why.
I think it's an age thing. I think I would have similar sympathy for a 15-year-old boy who was groomed and recruited in that way. You know, I think that when we look at, and I do think that, you know, women were very much trafficked into the Islamic State. They were meant to be serial wives. After each husband was killed fighting, they would be forced to marry other fighters. It wasn't an option. You would be imprisoned or had your children taken away if you didn't. So some of these women were forced to marry, you know, husband after husband. And even if they had, for some mad or you know, reprehensible reason, believed that ISIS or fighting the Assad government in Syria was the right thing to do at some point in time, you know, I think if a 15-year-old girl is groomed and recruited with very sophisticated online recruitment methods. You know, I followed this closely, like watching the way that it all unfolded over Twitter, over Tumblr, over Facebook, sort of surrounding these young women the way a gang would or a way a sexual exploitation gang would. I think that having some nuance around responsibility for those who were underage and who were women who were very much trafficked is an important part of this story.
Azadeh Mavani is an author who's written about women who have left their home countries to join ISIS. Her book is called Guesthouse for Young Widows. Thanks a lot, Azadeh.
Thank you.
The Queen of the Skies. That's how some refer to the Boeing 747 plane. It's a huge jet, multiple levels, and British Airways was the biggest operator of the 747 for years. Today, though, British Airways announced that it will be retiring its entire 747 fleet. Joining us now is Phil Seymour. He's an aviation analyst with the IBA consulting firm in the UK. First of all, Phil, why is British Airways retiring its 747 fleet?
Well, actually, a positive thought is that these aircraft are all over 20 years old. They were scheduled for retirement in the next 3 years. So they were already looking to replace those four-engined aircraft with the new twin-engine modern jets. However, clearly the downturn caused by COVID-19 has accelerated that decision.
Tell us a little about the 747 and why it is so significant.
I think in the, you know, when it came into being in the very late 60s, it was the jumbo jet, wasn't it? It was the first of the twin aisles rather than the sort of narrow body single aisle jets to come into operation. It was distinguished by that hump at the front where a lot of airlines use that as a sort of a first class suite area. So it was clearly visible as being distinguished from any other aircraft that had ever flown before. This aircraft, because it was wide body and much larger, it just had a passenger feel about it that it wasn't going to be thrown around like other smaller aircraft.
For aviation experts and enthusiasts like you, is there something deeper, perhaps even sentimental about this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people in the industry are probably incorrectly emotionally attached to a lot of these aircraft. I was very upset when Concorde retired. But, you know, I think the British Airways 747s, because it was part of a much larger fleet, you know, hundreds of these were delivered over the years, to the fact that we were unlikely to see them operating out of the UK anymore is really a sad time. But this is probably not the time for emotional feelings about old aircraft, is it? So we should all be actually saying, look, job well done. Now it's time to move on to more fuel efficient twin-engined aircraft.
Phil Seymour is an aviation analyst with the IBA consulting firm in the UK. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Last week, the Trump administration announced that it was barring international students from residing in the U.S. while taking online-only university courses. Lawsuits were quickly filed. Then this week, the government rescinded the policy. But the anxiety it caused could do long-term damage to American schools trying to attract international students. The World's Rebecca Kanther has more from Shanghai.
Gu Huini runs an educational consultancy in Shanghai, helping Chinese high school students go abroad for study. When the announcement came out that foreign students risked being sent home because of the abrupt policy change, her phone started buzzing.
It just went viral. It was everywhere.
For the more than 360,000 Chinese students studying at U.S. colleges, the potential wrench in their study abroad plans caused a lot of stress. For incoming freshmen, the stress has been even more acute. Because of the pandemic, U.S. consulates around the world aren't processing visas. Lulu Gong is one of those students. For the past 3 years, she's been preparing to study abroad. Her excitement at getting into Penn State University was squashed when she realized she couldn't get to the U.S. Instead, she'll attend a freshman orientation on Zoom and then begin classes at a partner university in Shanghai. This is disappointing, to say the least.
I thought maybe I can meet a lot of friends in America. Also, I plan to do a lot of things, but now I just can't go there.
Gong's family is just one of many families here who've staked their future on education in the U.S.
They've invested lots of money and time to prepare their kids.
Private high schools with American curriculums, summer school programs, SAT prep classes, English classes, college consultants. It all adds up. Not to mention the cost of American tuition. Foreign students typically pay full price, no financial aid. The investment is huge, and more families in China are wondering if it's worth the risk. The Trump administration's latest policy shift is not the first one to impact Chinese students. Student visas have been harder to obtain, and visa lengths limited. Gu says in the past couple years, she's noticed a trend.
I've been receiving questions asking about Singapore or European countries or Canada rather than America. And this trend has been going on, I would say, ever since 2018, I've been constantly receiving more requests on this front.
Lily Zhao, another educational consultant, says she's also been fielding lots of questions from parents. Some families are thinking about applying to Chinese universities instead. Her advice for students? Diversify your options.
I encourage the student also prepare for the USA's application because we don't know how it's going for the next year.
One of Zhao's clients is Rita Chun, a 10th grader at a private school that uses a U.S. curriculum. Her mom, Tong Xuefeng, says they've already gone too far to switch course. They hold U.S. green cards and need to focus on a U.S. education.
We're stuck because it's really tough to get into a Chinese university after studying the U.S. curriculum here. So she has no choice. She must go out of China for university.
But she says other parents she's talking to are considering changing their plans.
What they're considering is that China and the U.S. have a tense relationship right now, and visas aren't as easy to process as before. So they're wondering whether they should switch to the U.K. or Australia.
Every day, Gu must manage the expectations and panic attacks of the family she works with. With each new announcement from the Trump administration or news clip that goes viral on the internet, she has to counsel her clients.
I would say, hold on, wait for at least a week before you get anxious. Basically, you don't know whether this is a final rule or this is just something, it comes out to test water. So I usually advise them to wait and to for everything to sit still and to become crystal clear, and then we make the move.
For now, Zhao and Gu are still encouraging their students to stay hopeful. In fact, they see this as perhaps a time of greater opportunity. If others give up their U.S. educational dream, maybe doors will open for the ones who stick it out. As for U.S. universities, they can scarcely afford to lose those foreign students. Chinese students alone bring in $15 billion of revenue, which could be one reason those universities are fighting so hard to keep their doors open to them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
You're listening to The World. The pandemic is altering a lot of our normal routines and traditions, including how people become U.S. citizens. Some soon-to-be citizens are going through drive-thrus, rolling down their car window while an official administers the oath at a distance, mask on. Anita Rosenberger took the oath behind the wheel in Detroit.
At first, I was disappointed because I thought, oh, I'm not going to be able to have the picture in front of the, you know, the emblem and the flag and all of that. But then I thought, how great is it that they're making this opportunity available that I don't have to wait? So actually, it was fun.
But even these only in the age of corona ceremonies are at risk. That's because the agency that oversees the citizenship process is in crisis. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me now. Monica, when did these drive-through ceremonies start?
They started about a month ago. It's a new process. For about 2 months, there were no citizenship ceremonies happening, nothing. It was at a standstill. And what these drive-through ceremonies are doing, they're attending to the massive backlog that existed before the pandemic even started.
How big is this backlog?
Well, the backlog since the pandemic has been about 100,000 people. But before that, there was already about 700,000 people waiting for citizenship.
And of course, some of them would be potential voters in November.
Right.
What were behind the delays even before the pandemic started?
The process to become a citizen has become more onerous. There are more questions being asked of applicants. In fact, a report just came out this week by the Migration Policy Institute. That's a nonpartisan think tank in D.C. And I spoke with Randy Capps, who led the research.
One of the reasons why it's taking longer is because USCIS officers are asking more questions, more detailed and more pointed questions. That's making it harder on applicants. They're having to prove things like, are they really married? Were they really married when they got a green card? Sometimes even reprove that they have a valid asylum claim. Were they really tortured? Did they really suffer abuse in their home countries? Things that USCIS wouldn't have asked in such detail before.
Monica, why is the government doing this? I mean, changing the process so much?
This extra vetting and the scrutiny that people face as they're trying to get their applications through is part of the goal of the Trump administration to say, hey, not everybody's going to get through so easily. We're going to add a lot of extra steps to this process. At the same time, Carol, the agency now says it's bankrupt or nearing bankruptcy because of COVID. And that this agency, USCIS, may furlough up to 70% of its workforce soon as August 3rd, if it doesn't get a cash injection from Congress.
Wow. Okay. So what does that all mean for things like citizenship ceremonies, all the other things the agency does?
It means that if Congress doesn't inject this $1.2 billion that USCIS is asking for, that you could see a lot of the immigration work being done by this agency stop. Think of this agency, USCIS, as the beating heart for immigration. So these drive-through citizenship ceremonies, who's going to staff them? Green card applications will take even longer to get processed. Asylum applications as well. And that is a real concern, and that is what USCIS is asking Congress for. They're saying we need that injection.
What's the likelihood that Congress will bail out USCIS?
We'll see. There's a lot of pushback from critics saying don't just write this agency a blank check, because while part of the blame, they say, can be put on the pandemic, there's also a strong critique that the new policies implemented by the Trump administration have made this agency work at a much slower pace. So there's a real concern that by giving this agency the money that it says it needs, it'll be adding to policies that are dragging down the processing of citizenship and other things that immigrants are asking for, and not making those changes that people say need to be made for things to work more swiftly and fairly.
Monica Campbell is our immigration editor. Thanks a lot, Monica.
You're welcome.
A tanker full of crude oil has been slowly rusting in the Red Sea. It's been parked off the coast of Yemen since war broke out there more than 5 years ago. Now it's an environmental threat. Mark Locock, the United Nations' top humanitarian official, said the tanker is carrying 1.1 million barrels.
That's four times as much as was discharged in the Exxon Valdez disaster, an event the world still talks about 30 years later.
For more about the threat that the tanker poses, we turn to John Ratcliffe. He's from the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He said on May 27th, they got news that seawater began leaking into the engine of the Soffer.
And this is a clear sign that corrosion of the vessel, which is only a single hulled vessel, is accelerating. And so we need to move as quickly as possible to address this. The incident on the 27th of May did not leak oil into the sea, but it did allow seawater to enter the engine room. And that could have destabilized the entire vessel, which would then have sunk it potentially and then released all of the oil into the sea. Mm. Now, luckily, that didn't happen. The Soffer Corporation, which owns the vessel, was able to dispatch some underwater divers to patch up the initial leak. It's bought us a little bit more time, but not much.
What's the worst case scenario here?
Just how bad it would be depends on seasonal conditions when a spill occurs. But in any scenario, it would be catastrophic. So if a spill were to occur in the next couple of months, you would see 100% of the fisheries along the Red Sea coast of Yemen devastated, which would cost $1.5 billion to the communities there. Many of those communities already need humanitarian assistance and couldn't afford that kind of impact. You could also see 500 square kilometers of agricultural land being affected because of essentially noxious gases that would be leaking from a potential fire on board. And we think that potentially the most devastating impact could be the closure of Hodeidah port for as long as 6 months. So Yemen imports pretty much everything, nearly all of its food, all of its fuel. And Hodeidah port is the main port of entry for most goods into the country. So if that port is taken offline for months, it's going to be catastrophic for millions of people in Yemen, including people who live far away from the coastline.
So what's being done to avert this possible disaster? What are kind of next steps here to deal with this?
The UN is very eager to help with this, and we've been doing our best to help with it for the last couple of years, actually. We have a technical team that's on standby, ready to deploy to the site and do a technical assessment that will tell us exactly what the condition of the tanker is and exactly what needs to happen in order to neutralize the risk, essentially. We need to be able to deploy that team as quickly as possible. They're on standby, and from when we receive permits from the authorities, they would be able to arrive at the site in about 3 weeks. It would take us a little bit of time to gather the personnel from different parts of the world to the staging area. We'd also need to hire the technical equipment and a boat to take them to the site. But we think we could be there doing the assessment and some initial repairs within 3 weeks of getting permission from the authorities.
All right, we'll be paying attention. John Ratcliffe is a humanitarian affairs officer at the United Nations. Thanks for the update.
Thanks very much.
Here's one more way you can stay connected to the world. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Top of the World. Each morning, we'll send you the inside scoop on the stories that we're chasing. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Goya is in hot water after its CEO voiced support for President Trump. It's not the first time the Spanish food giant has upset customers.
This alignment with Goya as the icon of culture, it doesn't work.
Rethinking food and identity within Latin culture. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. India has joined a club nobody wants to be in. 1 million cases of COVID-19. Only the U.S. and Brazil have also hit the million mark. And the cases in India don't seem to be slowing down. Ramar Mukherjee is a professor of biostatistics at the University of Michigan. She's been modeling India's outbreak. Ramar, more than a million cases, nearly 40,000 cases a day and rising. Has India reached the peak yet?
This is the million-dollar question. And I think that our research shows that the peak is quite far. And the reason for that is the concept of a national peak in India is quite nebulous. What I expect and the models show is that there would be a wave of peaks cascading through the country in the next couple of months. Initial localization of the disease from major metros has now really spread across the country to the eastern states and the southern states. So I wish that I had better news to bear, but the models are not pointing to that direction right now.
I was going to ask, where are the cases concentrated?
So for a long time, most of India's cases were coming from six states, more than 90% of India's cases. And Maharashtra always was at the top of the chart. And then there was a peak in Delhi and Tamil Nadu, which are the big metros. But now with the mobility of the migrant workers and reopening of the country, we see the reproduction number are rising across the board in multiple states. And some states are actually, like Kerala, are entering into their second peak after the initial strong control of the disease.
Are there any states or cities in India that have been fairly successful in flattening the curve?
Yes, that's a great question. Managing this pandemic across cities and states have been one of the striking things about modeling this pandemic. I'd like to share two examples. One is Dharavi. It's in Mumbai, Maharashtra. It's Asia's largest slum. The population density is very high here. It's a low resource setting. Odds are stacked high against us. But the people of Dharavi have been able to bend the curve through centralized isolation, community engagement, regular symptom reporting and tracking, enough PPE to the health workers. And so this has been a partnership of different sectors that have rose to the success in Dharavi. And the other one is New Delhi, where the cases were spiking at one point of time with dire projections. But the effective reproduction number, that's the only state which has been able to maintain it below one for the last 14 days. And it's around 0.8.
That's the number of other people that get infected by one person who has the virus.
Yes, exactly. And that has been through increased testing and increasing bed capacity in hospitals.
Now, the coronavirus has hit the poorest, the hardest in India. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has said that letting people go back to work is necessary for millions of people and the economy. At this point, though, do you think another lockdown should be implemented?
So this is also a very difficult question, because I think that after 9 weeks of lockdown, the national strict lockdown was not sustainable for India. So I think that that would be last strategy. But before that, I think we really have to think about regional and modulated lockdowns, if they are effective, before calling for a national lockdown. But I have to say that controlling the virus effectively is really key to having the economy swing back up, because human behavior is changing. Even if the economy is open, people are not going to go out as long as the virus is dictating our lives.
What are your models projecting for India by the end of the summer? I mean, what are you watching for?
So the first million cases in India took about 168 days. The first million cases in US took about 97 days. The next million US took a lot quicker, 43 days. The third million came in 28 days. So I want Indian people and the public and the government to be aware that the next million may come quite quickly. And our models are projecting that it's going to be right around India's Independence Day, August 15. What I'm seeing is that steady growth of cases throughout the next couple of months until something really dramatic happens.
Brahma Mukherjee is a professor of biostatistics at the University of Michigan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
It's a summer like no other.
This is the most serious public health crisis that we've collectively faced in the world in more than a century.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's this week's guest on the podcast The Economist Asks, a collaboration with The Economist magazine. John Prito is the magazine's U.S. editor and joins us from London. John, it's been a tough week for the CDC. I mean, among the many disses from the White House was the Trump administration ordering hospitals to bypass the CDC and send all COVID-19 patient information to a central database in Washington. What was Dr. Redfield's mood when you talked to him?
I think he's pretty phlegmatic, Carol. I mean, he's in a difficult position, right? He runs what's still, I think, the world's premier public health agency. He's serving an administration that consistently has put out messages that run counter to the best advice of public health experts. But if he contradicts the president publicly, then he gets even less influence than he already has, and it makes the work of the CDC even harder.
And of course, I'm sure the topmost thing on his mind right now is this surge of cases that are happening in many parts of the U.S. What does Dr. Redfield attribute that to?
Yeah, well, I pushed him on this. You know, I thought from where I was sitting, looking at the numbers, seemed to be that you had a lot of governors, particularly in Sunbelt states, who'd opened their states up too early, you know, shut down when they had very few cases, started opening up when the caseload was rising, and then you had sort of exponential transmission after that. He actually pushed back a little bit on that, and he thought that what was really going on was that the week really around Memorial Day and after Memorial Day, you had a lot of people from the Northeast, where there were a lot of COVID cases, taking vacation in other parts of the country, and they brought the virus to other bits of the country where people were more reluctant to take measures to keep it out, like wearing face masks and doing social distancing.
I think it's more likely related to migration of people from areas of what were now declining transmission that went on vacation for, say, May 26th through the beginning of June. And then before we know it, we had seeded many parts of the South.
It's an interesting theory. Did Dr. Redfield voice any regrets or lessons learned in how prepared or unprepared the U.S. was in the beginning of this pandemic?
He did a bit. Again, he has to be a little tactful here. CDC's come under a lot of criticism, particularly for being slow at getting a working test out. There was a key delay of about 5 weeks that meant the U.S. was pretty much unsighted. He said that he regretted that the U.S. hadn't consistently invested in public health, you know, for a long time, really, and that this pandemic had really shown up how short-sighted it was not to take this more seriously as a threat to the nation.
For the first time this week, we saw President Trump appear in public wearing a mask. The idea of wearing one has become very politicized. Does Dr. Redfield recognize that there are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, just will not wear a mask, and they will follow only what President Trump says and does?
I think he does implicitly. He talked a little bit about how hard it would be to solve this crisis if people were political and divisive about it. Clearly, you know, America's really the only country in the world that I'm aware of where mask wearing has become such a clear partisan issue, with, you know, one party's voters on one side, the other party's voters on the other side. Broadly speaking, it's going to be really interesting to see if the polls on that shift now that President Trump has been seen wearing a mask, that could be helpful. I was very struck by how important, Dr. Redfield says, both wearing masks is and social distancing is. You know, he thinks that if Americans made a big effort on both those things, we could get the virus, you know, get this peak right down within about 4 to 8 weeks.
I'm glad to see, obviously, the vice president, the president, you know, now wearing face coverings. We don't need to be politicizing these public health interventions. You know, face coverings should and isn't a political issue. It's a public health issue. And really, there's not value to have these interventions then get politicized.
It's now July. The coronavirus has been with us for 7 months. Looking back, does Dr. Redfield wish that some things were done differently?
I think he does. I think he recognizes also that this virus has been hard because we've been learning about it as we go along. It took a while to understand the importance of asymptomatic infections. That's, you know, one of the things Dr. Redfield points to. I think also he thinks that the virus was much more widespread in the US earlier this year, but because the testing regime wasn't up and running fast enough, the country was unsighted to some degree. So I think there's two big areas where things ideally would have been done differently.
Is Dr. Redfield optimistic that there will be a vaccine soon?
He's very optimistic on that, Carol. Yeah, very clear. He thinks there will be a vaccine by the end of the year. He pointed to the number of, you know, competing teams around the world trying to develop a vaccine. And yeah, he was very, no ambiguity there, no hedging, very clear on that.
I've never seen vaccine development move quicker. There's a highly effective partnership between the private sector and government to make this happen. And I would assume that we're going to have somewhere, hopefully, between 1 and 3 vaccines approved for human use prior to prior to January. That said, we can never, you know, science has its own timeline. We can't predict, but I'm much more optimistic than I was 12 weeks ago.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the CDC. He spoke to John Prideaux, U.S. editor of The Economist magazine. To hear more of their conversation, check out The Economist Asks podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Black Lives Matter movement that began in the U.S. has reverberated around the globe. For one grieving family in rural South Wales in the U.K., the movement has given them hope for justice. Last summer, 13-year-old Christopher Capessa, who was black, drowned when a schoolmate, who is white, pushed him into a river. The judicial system refused to prosecute the suspect. But now that could change. Reporter Brenna Daldorf has our story.
Christopher was probably the most bubbliest live wire you could ever wish to meet.
That's Hilary Brown. She's a lawyer based in Barrie, Wales. She first met Christopher Capessa back in 2018 when she was giving Christopher's mom, Alina Joseph, some legal advice. She said Christopher was always in motion.
He didn't stay still. He was absolutely full of life and full of fun.
Those images of Christopher have been precious to her ever since she got a call last summer.
My colleague contacted me and told me that there had been an incident and Alina's 13-year-old son had sadly died.
Christopher was gone. Brown drove up the next day to be with Alina, who's a single mom with six other children. Brown was worried Alina wouldn't have much support in the village where she lives in rural Wales.
I believe she is either the only or one of two black families that live in the area. And so I thought it would be absolutely necessary for myself and my colleagues, two other black women, to travel up to speak with her.
When she got there, she found Alina in a state of shock. Christopher had been out with a group of schoolmates when he drowned.
She was being told that Christopher sadly died as a result of no more than a tragic accident.
That's what the police said. But it wasn't clear how Christopher, who couldn't swim, ended up in the water.
Initially, there was a version of him jumping in the water, and quite quickly there was a version of him slipping into the water. And within 3 or 4 days, there was another version of Christopher being pushed into the river.
Brown started to have doubts about the police investigation. There were at least 14 witnesses to Christopher's death, but she says initially the police only interviewed 4, and that wasn't all.
We had gone to visit the scene and was absolutely dismayed to find out that the scene hadn't been secured.
And there was something else that Brown thought the local police weren't taking seriously, but that Brown, as a woman of color, immediately thought of. Since moving to Wales in 2011, Alina and her family had faced serious racist abuse.
There was a physical attack of one of her children. Another of her children, a little girl at the age of 5, was urinated on. The family received threats, letters, abusive phone calls, graffiti, and all of the usual very unpleasant ways that people can try to terrorize and intimidate you.
That day at the river, Christopher was the only black child present. Alina and Brown worked with an anti-racism group to make a formal complaint about the investigation into Christopher's death, and a new investigative team was brought in. Eventually, the investigators handed over their findings to the Crown Prosecution Service, or CPS, the body that decides if a crime can be prosecuted. In February of this year, the CPS sent Brown a letter.
The letter informed us that the Crown Prosecution Service had decided that although the evidential threshold for a charge of manslaughter was made out, it was considered not in the public interest to charge anybody with the manslaughter of Christopher.
So Christopher had been pushed, but they didn't want to prosecute the kid who did it. They argued that the point of the youth justice system is to make sure a minor doesn't reoffend. And they said the suspect was a good student, mature for his age, wouldn't do something like that again.
I had this overwhelming feeling that the Crown Prosecution Service had considered a priority to be to protect the young boy and place no value on the life or death of Christopher. I believe that had there been a different situation where 14 or 15 young black boys and girls were present, and an incident led to the death of one white boy, I honestly and firmly believe there would have been arrests and there would have been charges.
Brown helped Alina file an appeal. They were waiting for a response when, in May, George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis, and Black Lives Matter protests occurred across the world, including in South Wales. Brown says it's changed the discussion.
It has focused a lot of people's attention to the frequency of injustice for the black community, which hopefully increases the amount of anxious scrutiny that the justice systems comes under.
She says it's given her hope that the CPS will agree to prosecute the crime.
Often, all we have is hope.
The CPS says it will announce its decision on the appeal on July 20th. A few weeks ago, about 100 people gathered to mark the one-year anniversary of Christopher's death. They stood in a parking lot near the soccer field where Christopher loved to play.
We were able to release some white doves representing Christopher and his siblings. I think we went through every season in the day. We went through rain, we went through wind, and we eventually ended up in sunshine as the doves were released.
For the world, I'm Brenna Daldorf.
You may have heard about Beangate recently, when the CEO of Goya Foods sparked controversy.
A big backlash today, a campaign to boycott Goya Foods after their CEO praised the president.
Sparking backlash and the hashtag Goya Away.
As the calls for a boycott spread, Goya's CEO, Bob Unanue, doubled down on his support for Trump. Reporter Gabrielle Burbe dug deeper into the controversy. Her first stop, a photograph on a can.
Upon first glance, Puerto Rican artist Isabel Turner's 2018 photography exhibit looks like a colorful shrine to Goya, with canned vegetables and Goya prayer candles laid out on an altar of banana leaves. But look closer, and you'll see old archival photographs of the artist's family, where the can's ingredient label used to be. Except, everyone's faces in the photos, they're covered with small white price tags.
I wanted people to see that, like, oh, I could buy this. Oh, I could take this. Oh, this is for sale. Oh, this family picture, that's for sale. I wanted everything to have a monetary value within that setup.
Turner spent more than a year exploring the relationship between Goya and the Latinx and Caribbean communities. For many households in those communities, Goya is more than just a pantry staple. It's a means to make the dishes that feel like home and bind families together.
Funerals and weddings, I think of these meals. I think of the flavors of this food. I think of Puerto Rico, my grandma.
Dishes made from Goya products served as a bridge to Puerto Rico in Turner's large family gatherings, like this one. Growing up, she felt like Goya was part of her Puerto Rican identity.
Also, handing off of the torch of culture, right? Learning how to make these foods and the memories I have entangled with them, I think are representative of the torch being passed down to me, like the culture being handed off.
But Turner's relationship with Goya changed after the 2017 Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York City.
Everybody's waving a flag, blasting music from cars, people are singing on top of floats. It just makes my heart feel so warm to see so many people filled with so much pride for their homeland.
But in 2017, Goya ended its 60-year relationship with the parade, pulling its sponsorship after parade organizers decided to honor the Puerto Rican activist and revolutionary Oscar López Rivera. Rivera was a leader of the militant group called the Armed Forces for National Liberation. Many Puerto Ricans see him as a freedom fighter, others as a terrorist. Goya's decision to pull out of the parade because of Rivera proved really controversial.
The main thing was people saying, you're Goya, like, you're an iconic symbol for the Puerto Rican community. Like, how could you drop out of this?
The outrage she saw in her community, it made Turner reflect on her own relationship with Goya and ask herself, if Goya wasn't for Puerto Ricans, who was it for? Why, she wondered, had Goya become a symbol, a representative of Latinx identity?
I think what sparked that was me thinking about my own family, who was behind these products, whose cultures have been boiled down to fit into these packaged goods.
In her search for an answer, she began experimenting with overlaying her old family photos onto the labels of Goya cans. This experiment turned into an entire series, which she called Tiene que ser bueno, translating to It Has to Be Good. If you know Goya, you know it's one of the brand's most popular marketing slogans. Turner was struck by how much Goya pushes the idea of achieving the American dream through consuming their products. They even state this mission on their website. But the way she sees it, Puerto Ricans have never been granted the American dream. And Goya, she felt, never really cared about the relentless hardships the Puerto Rican community has faced. She realized she needed to divorce her Puerto Rican identity from Goya. So she used her series to do just that.
It was a death or a goodbye to Goya in a lot of ways. Goodbye to that chapter of them being my iconic symbol for my culture.
Turner says the recent call for a Goya boycott echoed the outrage she and others felt back in 2017. She said she's not surprised that Goya's CEO would voice support for President Trump, who has openly disparaged communities that identify with the Goya brand.
This alignment with Goya as the icon of culture, Puerto Rican culture, Latinx culture, it doesn't work.
Now, with recent boycotting, she urges people not to stop there, to go deeper in thinking about food and identity.
I feel like rebuilding an identity through food and decolonizing culture starts with thinking about the things you buy, but don't just jump to the next Spanish food brand. Look into what do they post on their website? Who are they?
For Turner, letting go of Goya didn't have to mean letting go of the food that connects her to Puerto Rico or her family memories.
I don't think you have to lose your culture or you have to lose the flavors, because once upon a time, there wasn't a Goya.
For The World, I'm Gabrielle Berbe.
To see what artist Isabel Turner's pieces look like, go to theworld.org. In the U.S., we're breaking daily records for new coronavirus cases. Despite the surge, things are still opening up.
For the health and safety of everyone, cover your mouth and nose when coughing and sneezing.
That's how people entering Disney World in Orlando are being greeted. In Europe, bars and restaurants are reopening with a more stringent approach to keeping people safe. Here's The World's Stephen Davey.
Tables are far apart, people are eating outside, and there's lots of plexiglass. Then in the Netherlands, there's a restaurant that's taken things a step further. They've put up small greenhouses with just one table inside. A patron there told a German TV outlet the greenhouses are kind of romantic.
It's actually really nice. It's super cozy. I think it would be also very romantic if couples are coming here.
Other restaurateurs are getting even more creative. A cafe in Germany issued patrons special hats with pool noodles attached. You know, those foam floaties. They've been put on the hats to keep diners far apart. Then there's the landlord in Cornwall, England, who had this shocking idea. Johnny McFadden installed an electric fence in front of his bar. You heard that right. An electric fence to keep customers from getting too close to the bartender. McFadden told the BBC about his contraption.
I have heard from my insurance broker. He was panicking a bit. And it is, as long as it's signposted, you know, warning and all the rest of it, electric fence, it's quite legal.
Yes, social distancing is critical these days, but an electric wire?
People are like sheep. Sheep abide by it, so people will as well. And it's working.
Now, maybe McFadden is just having some fun with us. He's not really going to shock people that get too close. Or is the wire actually hot?
Is it switched on? That's a question. Would you like to try and find out?
That's one way to ensure social distancing. For The World, I'm Stephen Davey.
And that's it for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.